Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. Inside Education is a weekly programme about the world of education from an Irish perspective. You can listen to or download hundreds of previous episodes of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. This week on the programme, I'm delighted to bring you the second part of my interview with Professor Gert Biesta, who is Professor of Public Education at Maynooth University. His areas of scholarship include the theory and philosophy of education, education policy, the theory and philosophy of educational research, teacher education, curriculum, and the civic learning of young people and adults. You can find out more about Gert Biesta at his website, gertbiesta.com, that is GERTBIESTA.com. In this second part of my interview, I began by asking Professor Biesta who he is writing for when he writes about education.
I think I have teachers in mind, because I think that ultimately, yeah, the most significant things that happen in education happen through the work of teachers. And I just want to help teachers to broaden the languages and discourses and vocabularies. So I never try to say to teachers you should do this and not that, but I really find it important to show possibilities, different ways of looking at things, bringing in different words. But teachers have to make good education out of that. So I think that's sort of my primary audience. But I also hope that policy makers at different levels, I think I also have them in the back of my mind. And I think, well, it would be good if you would have a look at this as well. But I never have this ambition to tell people what to do.
I'm kind of paraphrasing something you've written yourself, but is there an educational way to speak and think about education?
This comes out of an experience I had when I moved from the Netherlands to England about 20 years ago. And I still remember I was, first 2 months in a room with colleagues, and we were talking about research we're doing and just sharing ideas. And then at some point, I don't know what it was about, but I asked, is that an educational question? And then the room got quiet and people looked at me and they said, they wondered what I was saying there. And over time, I realized that I was trying to speak Dutch in English. And what became both a frustration and a fascination is that conceptually in Dutch and German and some other languages, you have words and conceptual distinctions to talk about education that you don't have in English. Like the idea that you can use the word educational as an adjective. So I've been working a lot on that to try to express in English what's going on here. It remains an interesting thing to do, to go back and forth between two different traditions and try to articulate ideas from one tradition in a language that's not immediately suited for it. But in the idea of educational ways to engage with education, I always try to make the case that education is a reality in itself with its own orientation, and it's not an applied field. So it's not applied psychology or not applied philosophy or not applied sociology. That's not to say that these insights are not important, but they always need to become incorporated in an educational way of thinking and doing. I can give you a little example to make it a bit more concrete. One thing that has become very popular on internet is the marshmallow test. I don't know whether you've seen that. And I was in a seminar with a psychologist.
Maybe I should just say, for listeners who might not have come across it, this is where a child is shown a marshmallow and the researcher tells them that they will leave the room and come back in 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And if the marshmallow is still there, they'll give them a second marshmallow.
Yeah.
But what the child doesn't know is that they're actually being observed during that time.
Yeah. So I think this is purely unethical research. So it's shocking because there are clips on YouTube that put a very funny and upbeat music behind it where you think, oh, this is just funny, but, and I think actually it's child abuse, but there was a researcher there who said this is a really important test, because when we do this with children at a fairly young age, I think the children are about 5 or 6, we can predict with a very high percentage of accuracy how successful they will be in secondary school. Now, that's a psychological argument, you could say. And he said, therefore, the test is important because it says something about development and the ability to delay gratification and all that. My immediate reaction as an educator was, if that is the case, then there is something wrong with our education system. If this test predicts success or failure 10 years later, then we have an education system that's not helping every child to get there. That's a bit an example of where a psychological way of looking at the world and an educational way of looking at the world are very different. So the psychologist would just accept this as a fact of human development. The educator asks the question, but how can we, in a sense, make this fact invalid? How can we create an education system where also the children who at the age of 5 cannot delay their gratification can also be successful 10 years on? That's an educational way of looking at the world, I would say.
Yeah, that really does clarify it. It's a really good example, I think. You've said that those disciplines like philosophy, psychology and sociology, that they can yield insights for educators. And you are particularly grounded in philosophy and philosophy of education, I suppose. How do you think philosophy can inform the work and the practice of teachers?
I think that philosophy is good at asking good questions. So there you can say philosophy is a discipline in the sense of disciplining yourself to always ask very precise questions. That's also how I engage with philosophy. When I look at the history of philosophy, the big sort of breakthroughs are never when people give a new answer to an existing question, but when they change the question. So I find that really inspiring, if it's possible to ask a new question. I think that's partly the ambition I also have to. Well, a lot of people say, well, learning from and being taught by is exactly the same. And then to ask, well, could there be something fundamentally different? So, that drives me a little, I think. So their philosophy is helpful, but I think it's helpful to think better about education, but you always need to bring it back to education. So you have to be careful that even as an educator or a teacher, when you read philosophy, that you don't end up just in a philosophical discourse, but that you ask, is this going to help us in doing the educational work and raising the educational questions? So there is quite a lot of literature in philosophy that has emerged about what a gift actually is. And you can say that's very technical, or it's esoteric, or it's trivial. That's all fine. But I find it very helpful to then think, well, what is this gift dimension in teaching? Or what does it mean when something is given to you? And then suddenly, for me, that becomes very helpful in, going back to educational questions.
So if you were to design a module on philosophy of education for future teachers, mm-hmm. how would you go about designing it?
I'm not sure. I would probably do it on the basis of topics, not philosophers, or questions, or themes. So actually, that's probably what I've done in my own work as well. This whole question of teaching is a question that's keeps returning in modern philosophy. It starts with Socrates, and people still talk about Socratic teaching, so that's very influential. Most people stop there, so they know about Socrates, and say, well, it's about asking good questions, and then you'll get there. I then discovered that Kierkegaard, a Danish philosopher, has a whole critique of Socrates and his ideas about teaching, which I found so helpful that I talk a lot about it, and recently was in a seminar of someone who works in teacher education and physics teaching, and he was struggling with a particular problem, and then I said there is something really interesting in Kierkegaard's work where he says teaching is double truth giving. Now, at first sight it sounds very abstract, but Kierkegaard says teaching is not just giving someone the truth, but the real work is to help students to recognize that truth as true. And this is a problem in physics teaching, particularly when the teacher is good at physics. The teacher has the frame for understanding everything that can be said about physics. But students lack that frame. So if in the teaching you're only transferring the content, but you never help students also to get the frame within which the content begins to make sense, actually you have very poor teaching at a very sort of concrete level. And this is Kierkegaard when he talks about double truth giving. And suddenly, this physics teacher educator, it was a breakthrough. He said, I've never looked at teaching in that way, but it makes so much sense that it's actually two levels at the same time. And if you don't work on those two levels and forget the framing, then the students who get it because they have the frame. But the students who don't get it, they will never get it because that frame never arrives. And what I really like is that Kierkegaard does this in the context of a very theological discussion, where he says, this is actually what revelation is. So revelation is not just that God gives you the truth, but that God also gives you the conditions under which you can accept it as true.
And if you go back to that module on philosophy of education for teachers, what topics would you include?
I would probably put teaching very central because, for me that's the most beautiful and mysterious thing that actually also happens in human interaction, and to look at that from many dimensions. Funnily, I could fill a whole module with just that, and I'm pretty sure that in other modules students will be exposed to learning theory and psychology of learning, so also for strategic reasons I would strongly focus on teaching.
And how would you teach it?
Well, that's another nice idea. So I've written about the rediscovery of teaching and the return of the teacher. But there is a danger here that when you say that the teacher needs to come back into the educational conversation, that before you know it, the teacher again becomes the authority figure. So together with a good friend of mine, we're talking a lot about this and came up with the phrase, teaching for the possibility of being taught. So you can say this experience of being taught can come from all kind of different directions. And if we think that the teacher is the one who can produce that experience, then we're back in authoritarian teaching. So I think I also recognize this in my own teaching, that I do an awful lot by putting, I would say, things in the orientation or the attention of my students. But what I cannot control is what happens in that interaction. And it can happen, nothing can happen. Or it can be that suddenly what they encounter there teaches them something. So it's a kind of indirect teaching that I would do, which looks quite conventional. But the only thing I try not to do is to control what students do with what they encounter, but I do an awful lot in putting things in front of them. So my students have to work really hard, but I developed a lovely program at Brunel where we took out assessment. So no assessment. And of course, students initially are very confused by that because they say, well, it's your job to tell us whether we are doing the right thing. But over time, you can say, well, ultimately, if you cannot come to your own judgment about whether you're doing the right thing, then you're not really getting a proper education, because you will always depend on sort of asking other people, am I doing the right thing? So if you take assessment out, you enter in a very different dynamics.
And did they attend?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Even though they weren't required to then, if there was no assessment?
Yeah, so these students were pretty motivated, but even I think they found it initially a very different experience and a bit strange and difficult, because they were constantly asked, they had to read books and write essays and do presentations, but that moment of sort of my judgment to tell them you've done it right or not, that never came. And over time, that did something really interesting. So for me, that's a nice example of what I think good teaching can do.
One of your early heroes in education and philosophy of education was John Dewey.
Yeah.
What aspects of his work are most informative for the practice of teaching in the 21st century?
So he was an early hero. And sort of, well, as Freud says, at some point we need to get rid of our fathers. So I'm making this joke that I'm still trying to write my last paper on John Dewey, but people keep asking me. I think where I've become a bit dissatisfied is that he has a lot of interesting ideas about the learning side of education, but very little about the teaching side. So I think that's a blind spot in his work. Where I find his work really important is actually in the critique he develops of the modern scientific worldview. There are a lot of people who say, well, Dewey applies modern science to philosophy, but I think that's not at the core of his work. If you look very technically, so I did my PhD on Dewey, so I've read a fair bit of his work. I would say he actually applies ethical judgment to understanding what experimental science is. And by framing it in terms of judgment, he already says this is not sort of a machine where we do an experiment and we have the truth, but this is an interactive process where we need to make judgment about what's happening there. So in that sense, Dewey is not sort of a believer in hard experimental science. But what he also does is that he says experimental science is really good at one thing, namely doing experimental science. But we shouldn't take that for the whole of reality. And we shouldn't think that reason and rationality are only found in experimental science, and that everything else is just subjective. So what I really find the strength of his work is that he says, science is a small slice of reality. It's an important slice, but we shouldn't make it bigger than it is. And there are other slices, the arts, religion, politics, ethics, that are also really important. And we need to work hard to understand those domains in sort of their own integrity, rather than that we look at all those domains through the lens of science. I find that a really important message, but when you read books about Dewey, it's not where people would immediately go. So for me, that has become the most valuable thing that I've taken from my engagement with Dewey.
We're coming near the end, so I have some general questions I'd like to ask you. And the first one is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
I would say yes, but at the time I didn't notice it or didn't appreciate it. But now quite often when I give give talks. I talk about my PE teachers in secondary school. It's a subject I hated. I wasn't good at it, and it was no fit at all. But of course, the things you're not good at are also the things where the real challenges lie, where you can say, okay, there's work to do for you. And I think my PE teachers tried to get me a little closer to that. And at the time, I didn't see that at all. But sort of looking back after 20, 30 years, I see what they tried to do. So in hindsight, I think that, yeah, that is something that I appreciate much more now than when I was in the middle of it.
What is school for, or what are schools for, in your view?
Maybe the shortest way of saying it is to encounter the things you weren't looking for. Because the things you're looking for, most people can nowadays find them. So you can say that the school should be a place of surprise. And surprise is a beautiful word, because a surprise is what sort of takes you. It has prize in it, and it sort of overtakes you.
It also runs contrary to the idea of teaching being traditional or teaching being cultural. Because if it's cultural or if it's traditional, it's predictable.
Yeah.
But you're going against that idea.
Yes, yeah. And fundamentally, I would say if the school is not a place of surprise, then we don't need the school. So I think it's quite important that as society we see the importance of that. It partly is also the tradition of liberal education. It's a nice title of a book on liberal education called Beyond the Present and the Particular. That sort of that movement where you say, well, the whole point of education is that you end up somewhere else from where you are now, particularly to open up directions that you wouldn't have immediately looked for. And yeah, that means that it cannot be entirely predictable from the perspective of the student, but also not from the perspective of the system or the perspective of the teacher. So if students come to school and they want to know everything that's going to happen to them, they are not ready for school. But I would also say they're not ready for life, because that would be a very odd attitude. So a baby is being born and said, I want to know exactly what's going to happen over the next 80 years, otherwise I'm not going to bother. Well, that's not a way to live your life.
And there's no rule for goals and objectives?
No.
Who or what inspires you?
I think what drives me is this fascination with, I think, almost everything I encounter, to see whether it can be looked at differently or understood differently or approached differently. Yeah, Margaret Thatcher is famous for saying there is no alternative. And what drives me is to say there's always an alternative, even if it's not obvious right now. That's the hard work we need, because if we say there is no alternative, then everything stops. And I think that's dangerous. So I think that drives me. And you can say there's a lot wrong about education, but there is also an awful lot right about education. And we shouldn't forget that. But I also find that marvelous, that every day in classrooms, in little encounters, marvelous things happen.
What's a typical day like for you?
Is there a typical day? In my last book, I have a little biographical statement, and I really like the last line, so I write in the third person, and I say, when Gert Biste is not working, he likes doing nothing. And I think I'm pretty good at doing nothing as well. I also do quite a lot, so when I work, I can work quite hard, but I can also let it go and just sit or read a newspaper, and even there with not a lot of attention. So maybe a typical day is a balance of doing a lot and doing nothing. And how that looks like from the outside, I don't know, but for me, it's pretty okay.
Have you a favorite book or writer or blog about education?
Yeah, well, that shifts over time. So I read very slowly, so I'm not a gregarious reader. And there is an awful lot written education that I just find really difficult even to engage with. And I know that also says something about myself. But there is a lot where I would say it's trivial, or there is no real question here, or just repeats things that have been said for a very long time. So I really enjoy reading things that suddenly open up a new perspective or a new way of seeing. I'm currently working my way through a big German book called Allgemeine Pädagogik, so General Theory of Education, you could say, by a German professor. It's very systematic, but about every 10 pages there is a really beautiful insight, so that's worth continuing it. Another little book I refer to a lot is by Homer Lane, who I came across because A.S. Neal, the founder of Summerhill School, said he all had it from Homer Lane, so then I wanted to find out who was Homer Lane. And Homer Lane was an American who came to England and set up a residential school in the beginning of the 20th century for teenagers from London who had all kind of criminal convictions and difficult things. And he has written a few short texts just about his practice. But there you can see what it means to do educational things in education in action. That's a book I often refer to because there are some beautiful examples of how you can get into an interaction with a young person, not in a directive way, not in a judgmental way, but really in a way that opens up a future, often in situations where society has already said there is no longer a future for you, and I think that's really damaging. But also where that becomes the self-perception of young people, who also say, no, there is no longer a future for me. And what Homer Lane does beautifully is, with little interventions, suddenly opening that future again. And for me, that's profoundly educational.
I just love that idea of education opening futures again. And that was Professor Gert Biesta from Maynooth University speaking about the writing and practice of Homer Lane. And that's all we have time for this week on the programme. Remember, you can listen back to this week's episode or hundreds of others by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, which was published by Routledge, is available from online bookstores. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.